Welcome back to Imagined Tomorrow. First, I'd like to apologize for the delay. August was chaotic and a bit hard for me, but I'm excited to bring another future to you. If you are new to this show, we explore one hypothetical future scenario for India in every episode, and we talk to experts, and together we see how the journey to that future might play out, keeping Indian realities in mind. I'm your host, Shreya Dasgupta. This time, I'll start with the past.
Hello.
Hello, Dumma. I'm Shreya Bolchi.
This is Dumma, my 90-year-old maternal grandmother. She has dementia, so she doesn't quite recollect recent events very well. But there's one part of her childhood that she vividly remembers. A brief period during World War II when she went to live in what is now Bangladesh. There, growing up, Dumma was quite a handful teenager. She would spend most of her days outdoors, climbing trees, hanging from their branches, yelling like Tarzan. This was a time when doctors of modern medicine were rare where she lived, where cuts, bruises and infections were common. Dumma remembers getting a bad case of blood dysentery once that made her suffer for many days. Looking back, she recollects eating guavas right off the trees she climbed, never bothering to wash them, and swimming in the local pond, gulping mouthfuls of water, the same water where people would be washing their goats a few meters away. Those unwashed fruits and pond water, Dumma says, probably were home to germs she was blissfully unaware of. So she's thankful to have survived all the infections she had and could have had, because at that time, many others were not as fortunate. In those days, infections and deaths from infections were common. There are stories from my family of a young father who died of typhoid, for example, and of a little girl who stepped on a nail and died a few days later of an infection that refused to subside. On average, there was a good chance you would die before you were even 40. But such deaths have gone down considerably today, Dumma feels, thanks to medicines that magically make you feel better, often in hours. One such magical medicine she's seen transform lives is the antibiotic. For us today, antibiotics are so commonplace that we probably don't even give it a second thought. But in the late 1930s and early 40s, when Dumma was busy climbing trees, she had never even heard of these medicines. Unknown to her though, British and American scientists had found a way to mass produce the first ever modern antibiotic, penicillin. They had to. World War II was wreaking havoc, and doctors were desperate for a way to treat burns and bacterial infections in soldiers and civilians. And so, penicillin became World War II's wonder drug, and it saved hundreds of thousands of lives. But even before penicillin was being used on a mass scale in World War II, scientists had discovered something alarming. Bacteria were already showing signs of fighting back. After all, bacteria have lived on this planet for billions of years. And they have survived so long by learning how to fight new toxic compounds that other microbes and animals keep throwing at them. For us, antibiotics that we isolated from microbes, then made in labs, were novel weapons against bacteria. But for bacteria, fighting these drugs came naturally to them. With every new antibiotic we unleashed, some bacteria died, yes, but some lived and developed mutations in their genes that helped them resist the very drugs meant to kill them. In the pre-antibiotic days, people died of infections because there were no magic antibiotics to treat them quickly. We face another future, a post-antibiotics era full of superbugs.
You have a huge use and abuse of antibiotics in countries like India.
So those stories which we used to hear that a person was playing in the garden, had an injury and then he was bedridden and then finally died in a few months. Those are the stories that will become reality again.
It's very scary
will we face a global crisis in the next year or in the next 20 years or will it be after 50 years? I don't know.
So this episode, we imagine a post-antibiotics future where bacteria become extremely hard to fight, where you're afraid of being scratched by a thorn and where you have to think twice before getting any of the surgeries and procedures that modern medicine has made possible. But this time, we'll see how we can avoid getting to this dystopian future. And the expert voices you just heard, they will tell us how. So, let's get started.
My own mother was sick with a very resistant infection in the ICU. I lost her 2 years back. And I saw it in action. She was a chronic pulmonary disease patient.
This is Dr. Jyoti Joshi, a medical doctor and the South Asia head of the Center for Disease Dynamics, Economics and Policy, or CDEP. Her mother, who was hospitalized for a long time, used to get frequent infections. One of those infections turned out to be very severe.
That infection that she picked up probably in the hospital, and by the time that infection was detected, because, you know, tests take time to come out, it was pretty late and her infection was not responding to the highest level of antibiotics given.
Studies from some of our hospitals show that infections from common bacteria that can give you anything from pneumonia to urinary tract infections or bloodstream infections and meningitis are increasingly turning out to be resistant to multiple antibiotics. This is a problem because resistant infections are much harder to treat. They require longer hospital stays and the alternative drugs can be very toxic on the body. In short, resistant infections can be fatal. Although we don't have precise numbers of how many people die from such infections in India, one estimate suggests that every year more than 50,000 newborn babies succumb to sepsis caused by bacteria that are resistant to antibiotics. Globally, 10 million people could be dying from resistant infections every year by 2050. India will probably be a big contributor to this phenomena of AMR or antimicrobial resistance if things remain as they are today.
You wake up only when you have to go through that whole issue. But that should not be the case. We don't have to lose so many lives for people to realize that AMR is a very grave problem and start acting on it now.
There are two ways to act, Dr. Joshi says. One is by preventing infections in the first place.
The lesser the infection, the lesser the use of the antibiotic and the greater the chance of resistance not coming out.
Like vaccines. Vaccines can prevent infectious bacteria from multiplying too much. So you reduce the chance of these bacteria developing resistant mutations. Take the pneumococcal vaccines, for example. These vaccines counter infections from Streptococcus pneumoniae, bacteria that can cause pneumonia and infections of the brain and blood, and are a big cause of death among children and the elderly in India. Studies from the US show that these vaccines reduce infections, which means fewer antibiotics are prescribed, and it also decreases the circulation of resistant strains, so fewer resistant infections. In 2017, the government of India made pneumococcal vaccines available to children in 5 states under its Universal Immunization Program. Until recently, though, these vaccines have been an expensive proposition for India. But last year in December, Serum Institute of India launched Pneumosil, India's homemade, more affordable pneumococcal vaccine. And now these vaccines may be extended to children across the country.
So this is a very useful but a long-term measure. And because vaccines are given as a prevention measure to large numbers, their effect volume becomes very big.
So developing cheap, effective vaccines against infectious bacteria could help slow down the journey to a post-antibiotics future. Another way to prevent infections is through hygiene in places like hospitals.
When you have cleanliness maintained in a hospital ICU, in the operation theater, in the ward, you have water available 24/7. You have a sanitary toilet available for patients, male and female, and for the doctors, with water running and a sewage system that takes the effluent out to a sanitary disposal. That is a very good measure of decreasing the chances of infection in a healthcare facility.
There are hospitals in India that do follow good infection control practices. At the same time, there are hospitals that don't even have clean bathrooms or running water in taps, where the hospital staff is overburdened and forget to even wash their hands before touching every patient. A few clean hospitals can't slow down infections because bugs can piggyback and move around with people.
So antibiotics are not shortcuts for in not investing in health systems, and that's where we are faulting. You also need to make sure you have good infection prevention and control and water and sanitation so that a person who reaches the healthcare facility does not catch an infection and become susceptible to resistance within it, you know.
Okay, so to avoid our dystopian post-antibiotics future, prevention is going to be key. We are all taught that prevention is better than cure. COVID has taught us that, although we tend to not see value in it until a pandemic smacks us in our face. But prevention is just one half of the battle. We are all too used to the magic of antibiotics and we need them. And so, the second way to tackle the future threat of a post-antibiotics era is to be smart about how we use antibiotics. At the moment though, we are being pretty stupid.
The most recent data shows the highest consumption for antibiotics in the world is in India.
When it comes to total antibiotic sales for human use, India is among the leaders.
But luckily, the per capita consumption, because our numbers are so high, is much lesser than several other countries.
So India has two problems. On one hand, many parts of the country don't have access to antibiotics or the right kinds of antibiotics. So people either die of infections or live with chronic infections that get mistreated, which in turn allow bacteria to multiply and form new and more resistant strains. On the other hand, many of us consume antibiotics when they are not needed, or for the wrong duration, or just the wrong kind. Both poor access and uncontrolled and inappropriate use of antibiotics are fueling antibiotic resistance in India. And one big reason for this is how easy it is for people to buy antibiotics here.
We have antibiotics available easily over the counter without prescription, when they are actually prescription drugs in our country.
In India, all antibiotics are listed under the Schedule H of the Drugs and Cosmetics Act, which means they can be sold only through a valid prescription. In 2014, some antibiotics were added to a special category called Schedule H1. These drugs don't just need a prescription, but the pharmacist has to maintain a record of the prescriber and details of the patient and of the medicine they've sold for 3 years. The record can be inspected by regulatory authorities anytime.
However, I mean, even now, 6 years down the lane, 7 years down the lane, if you go to a pharmacy, you and I know we can still get an antibiotic from the pharmacy without a prescription.
Because there's no one really checking as they should.
Now, the challenge is our regulators are so stretched in so many different roles. A drug inspector should be reaching a pharmacy like every few months to check whether that record exists or not. And the drug inspector has so many pharmacy shops within his own circle. And he's not just doing drug inspections. He's also giving drug licenses. He's also answering court cases or PILs that come up regarding pharmaceuticals, that he or she is too busy with several other tasks that this task cannot be performed up to any benchmark that is expected.
Clearly, the current system where drug inspectors are responsible for everything is not working. So Dr. Joshi and her colleagues are exploring if there can be a different form of regulation for a country like India. One that involves the views and opinions of people who sell, prescribe and buy antibiotics. What do they think will work within their settings?
The smart regulation option is an attempt to have a safe space to experiment and see if there's a different way that regulation can be approached. Basically, it consists of having very flexible, innovative options, and options here, I stress, rather than just A or B, you know, involving the different stakeholders who are a part of the problem to be a part of the regulatory environment and to enforce what is the aspirational scenario.
These options can just be very simple tweaks to the current system.
So, for example, for over-the-counter sales of medicine, even if there are rules that have been flouted and there's a punishment that is given, you know, it's just like a very short punishment for a day or two that the shop has to be closed and then the shop opens up again. And the people don't realize that this shop was closed for 2 days because it was given a punishment for giving medicines over-the-counter. So just by making that public and putting that notice up for people to see, makes them realize that, you know, this is an action that has been taken because of this reason, and they realize the value of the rule there.
It's not just the pharmacists who flout the rules. You and I do as well. By insisting on buying antibiotics for a sore throat or fever or an upset stomach without a diagnosis and a prescription. Farmers buy antibiotics in bulk to feed their animals or to spray on their crops, not to treat infections, but often to fatten up their animals and as a precaution to keep the produce unblemished. So Dr. Joshi says that to deter consumers like us, posters or large graphic warnings can be put up inside shops, like those on cigarette packs maybe, reminding consumers that they are also flouting a rule and that their actions have consequences. But it doesn't always have to be a deterrent.
It can also be a recognition of a dispenser or a pharmacist or a consumer who did not use an antibiotic over the counter without any need for it or a prescription for it. And such recognition, it doesn't have to be a monetary recognition. Even a non-monetary recognition in a social platform gives status to that person for the behavior that she has been doing. And that is something we need to do as a society. We have explored several other options, which we now plan to take back to the stakeholders and discuss with them, and then come out with options that they agree to use.
Let's assume that some of these options work and over-the-counter sales of antibiotics without prescriptions go down. There's still another problem to solve: getting prescribed the right drug for the right bug.
Sometimes there will be sort of loud bird calls and things like that.
No, that will be nice actually.
Okay, so but I'm just warning you, some of them can be quite loud.
This is Dr. Prashant Srinivas, a medical doctor and a public health researcher with the Institute of Public Health in Bangalore. He's speaking to me from a field station in BR Hills, which is a tiger reserve in southern Karnataka, where he currently attends to the people living nearby. He's worked in many different places, from Arunachal Pradesh to Kerala, so I called him to ask what he thinks about antibiotic prescribing practices.
Antimicrobial resistance problem is not only about limiting overuse, it's about moving towards rational use and appropriate use, which also includes providing access to antibiotics where they are needed.
At the moment, though, we don't use antibiotics appropriately or rationally. For example, studies show that our doctors prescribe much more broad-spectrum antibiotics than, say, European nations, especially for children. Antibiotics are often prescribed for upper respiratory infections like a cold, which are generally caused by a viral infection and get resolved with a paracetamol, lots of fluid, and rest. So how do we move towards appropriate use? Say you have symptoms of a urinary tract infection or UTI, so you have pain and burning while urinating. Ideally, you or the doctor will send a sample of your urine to a microbiology lab to find out what bacteria is making you sick and which antibiotics can actually kill them and which ones the bacteria are resistant to. The doctor will then prescribe the right antibiotics based on this information. However, these test reports can take 48 to 72 hours to come back. And when the discomfort interferes with your work or life, waiting 3 days for the right answer may seem like an overkill when you have prescriptions from previous UTIs or when someone in your family or a friend recommends an antibiotic that's worked for them. Or when the doctor can just prescribe a broad-spectrum antibiotic hoping it will work against whatever it is that you have, the good, the bad, or the ugly kind of bacteria. But managing the pain and discomfort and finding the right cure can both happen together, Dr. Prashant says.
I would have a conversation with you about how the next 48 hours is likely to be difficult. I will explain to you that you will probably still have some amount of burning and that I will help you with that. And there are also things you can do in terms of fluid intake, which will help. There's also symptomatic medicines that are available, which will decrease it, than immediately prescribing a broad spectrum antibiotic. But we have to find out together what kind of an microbe is there, so that we don't harm your body, we keep the side effects minimal, and choose the right medicine that will help you.
These kinds of conversations with patients, he says, are not that common.
I mean, the ability for us to have conversation about the need for carefully watching what pathogen is being infected, or making a determination of the actual problem, involves trust building. That's what I call a therapeutic relationship. Unfortunately, what happens is that we treat patients, we tend to treat patients at least, as passive recipients of a prescription. That's not how it ought to be.
But that's how it often is. Part of this is down to medical training, Dr. Prashant says. Some of it is because of logistical challenges, which I will get to in a moment. Sometimes it's because doctors are just overburdened. Whatever the reason, the lack of engagement and trust building can lead to patients having a warped expectation of what a doctor should do, how she should be treating them, and what she should be prescribing.
So you have, for example, on WhatsApp groups, doctors cursing the internet saying, oh, you know, patients are reading something on the internet and, you know, coming and asking for it. And doctors often succumbing to kind of pressure from patients to prescribe a certain medicine without actually engaging with each other as to, you know, what is being desired by the patient with respect to their illness.
So making the right diagnosis and prescribing the right medicine has a lot to do with first telling people how modern medicines like antibiotics are expected to work and how they should and should not be used. In rural or remote parts of India, like the ones where Dr. Prashant works, prescribing the right antibiotics is made harder by many other challenges.
One, the culture of sending things to culture is lacking. I don't know where it comes from, but it's just not the usual thing that people do. In primary health centers in our district, I would deem it very rare for a primary care doctor to be asking for culture and sensitivity tests, let's say in a UTI patient.
The second problem is access. Access of a patient in these places to doctors and hospitals and access to testing labs.
A typical patient that I am seeing, my hospital is already in a rather remote area. They are walking to my hospital from, say, 3-4 kilometers away. And if I have to, you know, organize culture and sensitivity to the patient, it takes a lot. It takes a lot of convincing the patient, and it also takes a lot of effort that I have to put.
As part of a non-profit hospital, Dr. Prashant says they try and make that effort. But for a private practitioner in such areas, it may not be worth it at all.
If I was a private practitioner living in this area, it just does not make market sense for me to be convincing my client to go 20 kilometers away by bus for a culture and sensitivity test. Because if I give such solutions, it might harm my client returning back to me. So the incentives for following antimicrobial stewardship norms are stacked against rural practice. And that's one problem.
One thing that might be a game changer are rapid diagnostic tests that can tell you in minutes whether your infection is from a virus or bacteria, and if it's bacteria, then what kind of antibiotics they are resistant to. There are companies that are trying to figure this out, but these tests will still have to be made widely available and will need to be cheap. For a country as big and populous as ours, we need other kinds of solutions as well.
So we are one of 30 districts in the state.
His field station is in Chamarajnagar district in southern Karnataka.
In an ideal world, I hope that in the next 5-10 years, for this district, we need to have periodic bulletins which inform the practitioners, not only human doctors, but vets as well, about what are the current patterns of resistance in our district.
Because there is huge geographical variation in what microbes live where, the infections they cause, and what antibiotics they are resistant to. We are constantly selecting their resistance patterns based on how we behave, how we move, and how we use antibiotics in an area.
Now, in a district like this, we do not have a system which systematically determines the patterns of resistance. We need to have at least once a year a survey of resistant strains and what are the common urinary tract infections, what are the common diarrheas, what are the antibiotics you should be considering as first line, which are the ones you should not be prescribing. We don't have it for hundreds of districts of the country. And that's a big problem because we don't know the magnitude of the problem. I would argue that we even need something like that at a sub-district level.
We do have some idea of antimicrobial resistance patterns across some Indian hospitals. In 2013, the Indian Council of Medical Research, or ICMR, created a surveillance network that today has about 20 hospitals across the country, like AIIMS Delhi and CMC Vellore. This is a good start, but 20 hospitals is not enough for a big country like India. One big challenge to having good data come out for every district or sub-district is the lack of well-functioning microbiology labs.
I would hazard a guess that probably more than half of the districts of the country do not have a well-functioning microbiology facility that can do culture and sensitivity and that can elaborately collect and sample different, you know, biological material from different doctors in the district.
But let's imagine that we have an effective system in place that sends out information on antibiotic use and resistance patterns to all sub-districts each year. I asked Dr. Prashant how he imagines this more efficient system to be used.
I would imagine that at a block level, there would be a group of people, which involves the private practitioners, the pharmacists, the government hospital doctors, and the tahsildar, veterinarians, etc., that they would meet once every quarter to broadly discuss what are the most common antibiotics that are being prescribed and what kind of information is coming from the state or district level with respect to resistance patterns. They discuss, it may take about half an hour, 1 hour, and they come out with periodically evolving criteria on what prescribing practices should look like in their own taluka.
Sounds pretty simple, right? Get a bunch of people together and get them to discuss what they should be doing and how they should be prescribing antibiotics.
But if you go back and see, is it easy to achieve this? It's so difficult. And one simple barrier I see is for example, the marginalization of nurses, midwives, pharmacists, and various other health disciplines from public health. Public health in India is heavily doctor-dominated. Doctors like me, yeah, we are the voice. But health is not only about doctors. Health is, for example, nursing. Health is the pharmacist. And many of these professions have not achieved the kind of power as well as legitimacy in shaping public health.
In short, avoiding a post-antibiotics future in our country requires solving complex social issues. That's something COVID-19 has made very clear. But it's not just social problems that we need to solve. We need technological solutions like new vaccines and new antibiotics.
These have to happen together. On one hand, we must advance our armor, our set of arrows that we have. But on the other hand, we must also work in the battlefield out there and make things better so that these arrows hit their mark, you know.
One company in Bangalore is building some of the arrows we need in this fight. And it's named quite aptly, Bugworks.
I'm actually a semiconductor guy. I used to design computer chips for a number of years, both in the US and then when I came back to India.
That's Dr. Anand Kumar. In 2008, he moved away from semiconductors and started a biotech company in Bangalore called Cellworks that used AI and mathematical modeling to simulate new cancer therapies. Then in 2014, he created a spin-off company called Bugworks, this time switching his focus on developing new antibiotics.
Because I was seeing that the number of deaths in India was starting to rise dramatically. Out of the 1 million people per year who die worldwide, roughly 35% or 40% maybe are from India, 300 to 400,000. If you include the babies and children who die of neonatal sepsis. And the many unaccounted deaths in hospitals owing to hospital-acquired infection, antibiotics not working. And the big pharmaceutical companies abandoned the space because it's not lucrative like diabetes or hypertension or cancer. So you either can say, oh my God, it's crash and burn, or you can say, let's try to fix this problem for our country and for the world ourselves. You have to think audaciously. You have to be somewhat naive to take the type of leap of faith that one requires to get into such a big black hole called antibiotic drug discovery.
And so Bugworks took that leap of faith and set out to solve India's problem in India. It's a small company with about 25 employees, but it wants to fix a giant problem that, as Dr. Anand mentioned, even big pharma companies have steered clear of since the 1970s.
So the antibiotic age started in the 1920s with Alexander Fleming finding penicillin, became a real drug in the 1940s during World War II. And then came the brilliant 50s, 60s, and 70s, where most of the good work happened. All the low-hanging and mid-level hanging fruits were taken in terms of good targets and good mechanisms. And then would you believe it, from the 70s to today, that's what, 50 years, there's been no new antibiotics, no new class of antibiotics. It's a hard problem.
It's a hard problem because of a couple of reasons. One, the science of finding potential antibiotic candidates is tricky, and it's a process that sees more failure than success.
Remember, testing a bacteria in a laboratory and killing it is one thing, but finding a drug that goes into the human being is safe and is able to go and kill bacteria in humans without impacting the human is extremely complex.
Another reason big pharma companies stopped making antibiotics is because antibiotics stopped making them big money. On one hand, it can take more than 10 years to develop a new class of antibiotics, that is, a group of antibiotics that has a novel way of killing bacteria or stopping them from multiplying. On the other hand, bacteria can learn to resist new antibiotics in a matter of just a few years.
When you have other drugs making billions of dollars, big pharmaceutical companies said, tough area, bacteria are constantly evolving, we can't crack it, plus the economics is hard, boom, they're gone.
And so today, it's mostly small companies like Bugworks that are still trying.
95% of the innovation in antibiotics all over the world happened from small to medium enterprises, SMEs. You know, that's incredible, which has never happened before in any other indication that big pharma works in. So it's left to the small folks to try to crack this problem scientifically and to figure out the business models.
Scientifically, at least, Bugworks seems to have cracked the problem. In just 2 years, after sifting through some potential candidates, Bugworks' scientific team found a new class of antibiotics that showed promise. Now, bacteria have learned to deal with toxic stuff like antibiotics in different ways. One way is that they simply kick out anything that they recognize as dangerous using these protein pumps that they have on their cell membranes.
And the team, through amazing work, figured out novel chemistry to avoid the pump.
It's like an invisible assassin. It avoids the security guard, enters a bad bug, and then strikes it down stealthily.
So we've been able to hit the bacteria at two spots, target A, target B. And because we do so, we're able to kill them quite quickly. So we really, really hit a jackpot, at least in preclinical, by coming up, by hitting two targets that are found across bacteria that cause urinary tract infection, abdominal infection, bloodstream infection, pneumonia, kidney infection, etc., etc. So the ability to have a novel compound, novel mechanism of action, hit your enemy in two places, avoid the enemy's defense mechanism, that is Bugworks.
The Bugworks team has seen their compounds work against a range of bacteria thanks to their collaboration with two big hospitals in Bangalore. These hospitals often deal with superbug infections, and so Bugworks set up clinical microbiology teams there to test out their products.
These hospitals know better than anybody else that a silent pandemic was happening around us, which is antimicrobial resistance. It doesn't have the dramatic rise and fall of a viral pandemic like COVID, but they were starting to lose people in hospitals. And it's taking longer and longer for post-operation patients to come out of hospitals, right? Because antibiotics don't work. You have to try A, B, C, D. So these hospitals realize that, holy cow, we don't have new antibiotics. Whatever we have is either pathetically not working or working poorly. Nobody's going to fix our problem. Here is at least a company trying to do something. I hope, you know, they have India as a priority area, which we assured them we did. So they gave us access.
Access not to the patients, but to the superbugs that were infecting the patients.
These are bugs taken from very sick patients with their permission. And these bugs are nicely cataloged and annotated and are kept in safe bunkers, if you will. And teams that are properly dressed work on these bugs. We don't know which patient it came from. We don't know what happened to that patient. Nothing. Completely anonymized. And before our competitors around the world could gain access to horrible superbugs, we did. So very early in our testing cycle, we were testing our early products on very bad enemies.
The Bugworks team has progressed quite quickly. They've tested the promising new antibiotics on bacteria in labs and on various lab animals like infected mice and guinea pigs. you need to do a bunch of these studies before you can move to testing a new drug in humans.
We have completed all the discovery and preclinical work, and we are just about to enter clinical trials.
Clinical trials, where a new medicine is tested on humans, also happen in three phases. Phase 1 tests if it's safe in some healthy people. Phase 2 and 3 test the drugs on a large number of actual patients, people who have maybe UTIs or pneumonia or stomach infections. These trial phases tell us if the drug is safe in patients and better than treatments already out there.
We got the approvals from regulators in Australia to do a phase 1 trial. A phase 1 trial simply tests the safety and tolerability of our product. It'll be on about 60 healthy humans who get paid to be tested fully ethically, properly done with utmost care for their safety and well-being in a top hospital in Adelaide, Australia, who are one of the world leaders for phase 1 study. We'll complete the first safety studies outside and come to India for phase 2 or efficacy studies.
If the clinical trials show that the new antibiotic candidates are not that safe in humans or not working as expected, it's back to the drawing board.
In fact, the probability is quite high that the first product going through the pipe will not go all the way. That's how drug discovery works. In drug discovery, the success rate is 5% or less, right? So it's tough. You do great job in preclinical and then you come to human and you find something that is you never anticipated in the animal. So failure is high. You learn from the first one, you make the second one better and you hope the second one will go through. But somehow if you get lucky and the first product goes all the way, wow, that would be a great story, not just from India, but from anywhere.
So let's imagine that. Bugworks new antibiotics are safe and work against a whole range of superbugs. What might happen next?
We would like to launch it in India, hopefully for pneumonia or some serious disease, and we could save hundreds of thousands of lives in our country. And then ultimately, it can also become a for babies neonatal product, but that takes several years to do. First, you always launch it for adults, then for young adults, and then you go to children. So I envisage this as a company that will have a global big pharmaceutical partner who will take the product to Western markets, and we will hold the licenses or access to low to medium income countries, countries of Africa, countries of Southeast Asia to be particular.
But remember, bacteria are good at learning to resist antibiotics, especially when there's inappropriate use. So what's to prevent this new antibiotic from also losing the war against bacteria if it's launched in India?
India is so complicated, right? Other countries, they don't have enough cases, so there's no volume. In India, what happens is our rural areas don't have access to good antibiotics. And in the city centers and crowded places, it's excess use of antibiotics promoting drug resistance. That means you need different business models to satiate those two audiences, correct? So it's complex. We don't have the answers to all of it, but we're thinking through all of this.
In any case, Dr. Anand says that no new antibiotics will be successful for long, unless the government of India makes some major changes to how antibiotics are used in our country.
Otherwise, no new company with new antibiotics will want to enter India. As I said, and I'll say it loudly, you will get overused, abused, destroyed. Plus, you don't get paid for it. Why should anybody want to come here? Except out of nationalistic, patriotic interest, like companies like Bugworks, they say, we are Indian, we want to solve a problem.
What worries him, he says, is that there is no one department in the government that's taking charge of fighting antimicrobial resistance.
There are about 13 ministries that are involved, Shreya, because AMR is not only a Ministry of Health problem.
As I had mentioned, antibiotics are used on farm animals and even crops. We discharge antibiotics in the wastewater from our homes and hospitals and release them from the hundreds of antibiotic-making companies we have in India into our lakes and ponds, often untreated.
So many different ministries have to come together. My biggest worry is, we don't have a champion in government of India. I know that the Prime Minister's office is worried about AMR, even more now because it's become much worse post-COVID. Tens of millions of antibiotic tablets are being used every day in India through COVID, whether the patient needs it or not. So such a heavy usage in a short period of time has never happened in our country before. So we are already seeing dramatic increase in drug resistance rates. So what keeps me up is if India does not have a strong national action plan and put a strong government body ownership behind it, that nobody will come to India. I'm worried that even the innovators outside the world I wish somebody succeeds. It doesn't have to be just bug work. Somebody needs to crack this problem. If they ignore our market because it's a market that will overuse their products, if they ignore our market because it's a market that won't adequately compensate innovative products, then we become an afterthought, Shreya. That's my biggest concern.
But what keeps Dr. Anand going is that his company Bugworks could play a role in shaping a future that stops us from going back to the pre-antibiotic days.
Not just Bugworks. There are a number of companies doing great work in India in diagnostic devices and drug discovery. I'm thankful to all of them. But that's what keeps me going. How many people can wake up in the morning and look at, you know, themselves in the mirror and say, wow, you have an opportunity of cracking a problem that's solved for 50 plus years. And by doing so, you can help tens of millions of people all over the world, your fellow countrymen and women to start with, but humanity as a whole. That's what keeps me going.
This episode was created and hosted by me, Shreya Dasgupta. The intro and outro music is by Abhijeet Shailanath. The episode was co-edited by Abhishek Madan. And I have a bonus episode for you. A short interview with Dr. Hanan Balki, who heads the Division of Antimicrobial Resistance at the World Health Organization. She had some interesting things to say about how WHO is looking at the future of the problem of antimicrobial resistance and where India stands in the global context. You can read transcripts of both episodes and the show notes on the website imaginetomorrow.com. If you like the episode, do give it a shout out and hit follow on your favorite podcast app if you haven't already. That's all for this episode. See you again soon.